Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and normally each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles, but we're here this time with a very special bonus episode about a specific Beatles film adjacent subject. To mark the 50th anniversary of Live and Let Die, one of the most successful and certainly most popular Bond themes of all time, written to order by Paul and Linda McCartney, we thought we'd take a deep dive into the origins of the song and explore the various connections between the Fab Four and 007 along the way. And to help us with the discussion, we have invited a very special guest and good friend onto the podcast, journalist and recognised Bond expert Neil Alcock. Hi, Neil.
Hello.
Neil, would you be so kind as to let our listeners know some of your credentials as the Bond expert?
Yeah, presumably I've got to justify why I'm here,
yes,
because this is a prestige podcast.
Yes. We need to make sure everyone realises that we haven't just got our mate from the pub.
On. Sure. Okay. I have some James Bond socks. And as you can see, this is not very good audio material, but I am wearing some Live and Let Die themed socks.
Very nice material.
That's all we need to know.
Is that good enough? Okay. Yeah, I do have other credentials, which are that I have been a Bond fan for a really, really long time. Like most men, I got into it when I was a kid, watching the films with my dad. And that never really went away. Got to the point where I talked about Bond so much that people just stopped listening, so I felt like I had to write about it online. So I started a blog, and I wrote a lot about James Bond on my blog, which was called The Incredible Suit. And as part of The Incredible Suit, I started a project called Blog Along a Bond, where I got loads of bloggers to kind of join in and talk about a different Bond film each month. This is a long time ago now.
I remember it very clearly.
Yeah. This is in the run-up to Skyfall. So
Ed and I were very involved in that. Well, I say very involved in it.
I was very involved. I think I read one or two of them.
Yeah. We were occasional contributors.
Yeah.
So that was fun, and that led on to some work for other websites like Film 4 and Virgin that I wrote for, and then eventually got into writing for Empire magazine. So I've reviewed some Bond films for Empire magazine, and done some podcasts for people like Radio 1 and so on and so forth. And I think the highlight of all of that was in 2015, I got to go to the set of Spectre for Empire magazine in Mexico to watch them filming the pre-credit sequence, which was really exciting.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you've met a few Bonds in your time as well, right? You've interviewed a few Bonds,
yeah.
At least half of them.
I've I met Pierce Brosnan once in a very awkward encounter, which was not a professional circumstance. It was very much a fan-based circumstance.
Well, now it makes it sound like you stalked him.
Yeah, I did stalk him a little bit.
And you ambushed him in a sandwich shop.
That's correct, yeah. And he was not that impressed. Anyway, I did interview him on a separate occasion later for Empire magazine, but I chose not to mention the sandwich shop incident in case he connected to me.
I'm surprised he didn't remember it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've interviewed Timothy Dalton, I've interviewed Roger Moore, and I have interviewed Daniel Craig twice for Skyfall and Spectre.
Amazing. Excellent Bond credentials.
Thank you. But the socks are still right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, Live and Let Die, first question for you. Why is it the best Bond theme?
Why is it the best Bond theme?
Yes.
As opposed to the best Bond film?
Well, why is it, without a doubt,
right,
and without any debate,
yes,
the best Bond theme?
Okay, slightly loaded question. I do really like it. It's up. It's in the probably in the top three Bond themes for me. I'm a big fan. I grew up in the 80s, and so the first Bond film that I saw in a cinema was The Living Daylights, and so that era kind of stuck with me, like The Living Daylights song by A-ha and A View to a Kill by Duran Duran are kind of among my favourites, but Live and Let Die is up there as a kind of classic favourite. I don't know, it's just I love all the Bond themes and I could listen to them all over and over again because I'm a ridiculous nerd fan and I can't help, like, I even like Madonna's song, which nobody likes. But there are a lot of quite soppy ballads in there, which are a bit wishy. It's not because they're soppy, it's just because they're a bit wishy-washy. But Live and Let Die has just got some proper oomph, right? It's got, it kind of swings and it rocks. It's got that little reggae bit and it's got those incredible kind of blasting chords that in the title sequence of the film are matched with a face which turns into a skull which bursts into flames, which must possibly have inspired Paul McCartney's kind of stage pyrotechnics every time he plays that live. I just think it's a really fun song to listen to, and it's just one that you have to turn up and play as loud as possible.
We're going to get into the song and the origins of the song and how Paul came about getting involved in that as a project. But can you give us, a little bit of context around the film Live and Let Die, how it where it stood in terms of Bond as a franchise when it came out, and I guess Live and Let Die being that, the song being a part of that as well, it felt like a bit of a change in the direction of the franchise at the time, right?
Yes, so Live and Let Die is 1973, that's why we're talking about it, because it's 50 years ago. The first Bond film, Dr. No, was 1962. So you had five Bond films with Sean Connery, the fifth of which was You Only Live Twice. He then resigned from the role. He'd had enough. And for the next film, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, George Lazenby took over. But he was not a particularly popular James Bond with audiences at the time. That film has kind of retrospectively been reappraised a bit, and people generally appreciate it a lot more now than they used to. But it didn't go very down very well at the time. And so Sean Connery was brought back for one more film, Diamonds Are Forever, which came out in 1971. And then he said, I've definitely had enough now. So because the Lazenby experiment failed slightly, the producers of the Bond films decided they weren't going to try and replicate Sean Connery. They would go in a slightly different direction. So they brought on Roger Moore, who had already been courted for the role in 1962 when Dr. No was made, and again in 1969 when On Her Majesty's Secret Service was made. But he picked it up in 73 for Live and Let Die. And it was a little bit of a change of direction. The films, certainly Diamonds Are Forever, the previous film, which was directed by Guy Hamilton, had got a little bit more comedic, a lot less serious than most of Connery's films, and certainly On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which was quite serious. So there was a direction that the films had decided they were going to go in, which was this fairly light-hearted direction. Guy Hamilton again directed Live and Let Die. And so, yeah, you had a bit of a new era, really, where they decided to kind of sweep everything to one side and start and do something a bit different. So Roger Moore is a lot more easygoing, lighthearted, takes it a bit less seriously. And along with that, they've got rid of some of the familiar tropes of Sean Connery's Bond. So Roger Moore smokes cigars where Sean Connery smokes cigarettes. He drinks bourbon where...
He smokes a ridiculously long
cigar. He smokes massively
long cigars. It's gigantic. It takes up the majority of the screen when he smokes that cigar.
While paragliding as well.
Yes, yeah, you're doing your Bond.
Course.
Yeah, it's one of a number of phallic symbols, I think, in that film, but I probably shouldn't go into that.
God, it's so subtle, isn't it?
So yeah, there was a bit of a change of direction, and as I think as part of that, you know, we can talk a little bit about how Paul McCartney got involved, but that song is certainly very different to the previous few songs that we'd had. They were kind of sung by traditional... I mean, trad is probably the wrong phrase to use, but singers like Shirley Bassey and Tom Jones, incredibly popular pop singers, as Paul McCartney was, but this was on a lot more of a rocky theme than had previously happened.
Yeah.
And you got this again in 2006 with Casino Royale, when Chris Cornell did You Know My Name. They went down a very rock direction, whereas everything previously had been kind of pop or... you know, ballads and what have you. And so, yeah, they just, I think, wanted to try something a bit different. And I'm not sure that the rockiness of Paul McCartney's song goes with Roger Moore's James Bond.
Yes.
But it is certainly a change in direction.
It's funny, actually. The next question I was going to ask you was how Live and Let Die is seen now in terms of the context of the whole franchise. Like, how well has it aged? It's interesting. In asking that question, I feel like the song hasn't aged at all. The song still feels very modern, but the film hasn't.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the film is quite dated.
Yeah.
Certainly in its attitudes towards gender.
Coffee machines.
And race and coffee machines.
There's an entire scene in this where M is looking at Bond's brand new espresso machine like it is like
from coming space.
From NASA. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, generally you will find if you look online at polls now, where people are ranking Bond films, places like IMDb and Letterboxd, Live and Let Die tends to turn up roughly in the middle. Personally, for me, it's a bit lower down. It's not one of my favourites, but I do kind of enjoy watching it because I've just got to the point where watching any Bond film is like a comfort blanket for me. So
they're all kind of at the top.
Yeah, they're just all there.
In terms of the Roger Moore ones, where does it rank for you?
Good question. It's kind of up there. Like, I don't mind Roger Moore as an actor and as a film star and as a person, having met him. He's very nice.
Right.
But as a James Bond, like, he's my least favourite James Bond.
Right.
Because I'm a bit of a Bond snob and I feel like Bond should be like he is in the books. And this is as far removed from the book Bond as you can get. So, you know, I have to take all that on board. I have huge problems with things in Live and Let Die, like the way that the villains are so unbelievably incompetent. Like, I think there are about 10 or 12 assassination attempts on Bond throughout the film, and every single one fails, obviously, because he's Bond. But also they fail in the most pointless and pathetic reasons. Like, the bad guys just, at various points, they just give up. Like, there is points where you could just... He's there, he's in the room, he's in front of you. You could just shoot him in the head.
Yeah.
And that has obviously become a trope of Bond films over the years, and Austin Powers takes the mickey out of that, and that's, you know, a thing that everybody makes fun of for the Bond films. But this is the worst offender, I think, in terms of chances that you have to kill Bond versus actual successful attempts.
Ed, I think you made the point before we started recording that there's a moment in the film where the big bad guy, although we don't know it at the time, Kananga, it's Mr. Big, isn't it, at the time, basically dismisses Bond and says, oh, just kill him.
Yeah.
But his henchmen don't do that immediately and instead allow Bond some time to flirt with Solitaire instead. Like, right, just watch. Yeah. Or just give him a bit of space, give him a bit of time.
Yeah,
and then
we'll
kill him in a second.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, he's about to die. Let him flirt with a girl for a bit. Come on. it's the least he deserves. Yeah. No, I mean, Roger Moore is always accused of sort of making the thing too lighthearted. And, you know, like anyone can see the differences between the Moore and Connery eras. But when watching this, I haven't seen this for a few years. First time I watched it for a while. And I was watching bits of this and thinking, oh, it is obviously more lighthearted, but there are bits where he's quite brutal. Even just in his attitude right at the start, where M is telling him about these other agents who have been killed. And one's called Baines, I think. And so this guy who he knew is dead. And he says, oh, I rather like Baines. Like, we shared the same bootmaker, something like that. And that's obviously like a joke in a way, like it's kind of, but it's very callous. Mm. Like this is a colleague of mine. I don't know whether like you go to work for MI6 and like, you know, your mates, you know, and you go out for lunch at Pret together or whatever. But like, but generally speaking, this is someone who he knew very well and he doesn't seem that bothered about.
Yeah. I think if you work for MI6, you have to half expect that every single day you turn up for work, somebody you worked with yesterday has been shot in the head.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. HR must be a nightmare. Right?
I kind of got a little bit of the opposite impression from that, in that I kind of got the impression that Bond didn't really know him. Because the person that comes to mind is, we shared the same bootmaker. Mm. Not that we went to Pret last week. like he knew Baines through his bootmaker. I was left with the impression that he didn't really know Baines very well at all. And that's...
I don't think it's among Roger Moore's most brutal moments in the Bond franchise. For Your Eyes Only has probably the most un-Moore-like Moore-isms.
There's a guy hanging over the edge of the cliff in his car, and he just
kicks it.
He kicks the car over a cliff.
Of course, you know?
That's very brutal. That. Yeah.
It's funny you're talking about Bond rankings. Upon watching it again now, I don't think I liked it as much as I thought I did, and I actually wonder if, when you look at all of the Bond titles stacked up side by side, when I see Live and Let Die, I do actually wonder whether or not there's a part of me that thinks of the song. It's like, oh, I like the song, Live and Let Die. That's a great one because I remember how great that song is, you know, and actually watching this again, you know, from beginning to end, actually I found it quite dull in places, dare I say it.
Yeah, it's a bit sluggish. There's that whole boat chase sequence.
It takes a long time.
It goes on for a while.
It's really long, and it's not particularly interestingly directed or edited. And for a large chunk of it, there's no score over it. And I know we're going to talk later about George Martin's score for this film, but that is largely absent from the boat chase. And it's moments like that where it does kind of, you start kind of tuning out a bit and looking at your phone.
I don't know if this is necessarily true of the sort of Bond formula or the Bond template, but by the time that boat chase happens, I felt like he's already had his big confrontation with the main bad guy.
Mm.
So, you know, normally that would, you're building up towards that.
Yeah.
And I remember when that happened, I was like, there's still half of this film to go. Like, what is there? And basically, it's just a series of chases and traps for him to escape from.
Yes.
For him to just get back to where he was, which was another confrontation.
Yeah. It's not a well-paced film. It's not... I mean, this is why it's not very high up in the rankings for me. But, I mean, you take it on its own terms. If you decided to do a Bond marathon... I mean, don't watch them all in a row for a start. That would be stupid. But if you watch like one a week, you would probably find that this was not one of your favourites. But I think, like for me, if I watch it isolated from the others, which is kind of how I do it now, it's kind of fine. You pick Bond films for the mood that you're in. And sometimes you're in a Live and Let Die mood and it works.
Fair enough.
But if you're in a Casino Royale mood, don't watch Live and Let Die, you idiot.
What were you thinking?
I mean, Casino Royale's right there. Just watch that.
But going back to, I guess, the main reason why we're here, everyone's always in a Live and Let Die mood when it comes to the song, right?
Sure.
There is never a bad time to listen to that song.
Correct.
Funeral?
Yes. He makes a good point.
This is now going to be the song that I want played at my funeral. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about how Paul got involved with writing this Bond theme. Am I right in thinking that he was approached to do this by Ron Cass?
Well, this is disputed in both Bond and Beatles lore, but the way that I understand it is that Ron Cass, who was... So you'll know more about this than me, but I think he was MD of Apple in about 68.
Yeah, I defer to Ed on all Beatles facts.
Yes.
Ed's given me the nod, so that works. Good. And he was also managing director of various other companies that were connected to or overseen by Harry Saltzman, who was one of the two Bond producers. He worked with Cubby Broccoli. Quite interesting, by this point, Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman had a bit of a falling out, and so they had produced all the previous Bond films together, they started to take them in turns at this point. So Harry Saltzman is almost producing Live and Let Die by himself. And I think Ron Cass, because he had the connection with Saltzman and he had the connection with McCartney, at some point it came into his head. Whether Harry Saltzman suggested it, I don't know. But he said to Paul McCartney, would you like to do a Bond song? Wouldn't that be great? And Paul said, yes, of course. So Paul went away and read the book of Live and Let Die, wrote the song the next day, apparently, or that afternoon, I'm not sure.
Yes.
And it kind of went on from there. He asked George Martin to produce the song. And I think as a result of that choice, George Martin was then brought on to do the score, the orchestral score for the rest of the film. I think that's how it works. But, yeah, you know, there's been various stories.
Am I right in thinking that there was an opening for George to do the score, because John Barry had up until that point done most, if not all, of the scores?
Yeah, he'd done all the scores apart from the first one. Monty Norman did the score for the first James Bond film, Dr. No, but Monty Norman had written a theme for James Bond, which was quite bad, and John Barry had been brought on to rearrange it, and so he arranged it in the way that we now know it, this very brassy, rocky, jazzy, swingy. I mean, it takes in so many different genres, this theme. And so John Barry then went on to score the rest of the film. But at this point, he'd kind of had enough of Bond. It was a lot of work for him for very little reward. He wasn't being taken very seriously in the industry, and he was getting more plaudits for the other stuff that he was doing. He was also working on a lot of musicals at this point, and so I think he just kind of turned his back. I mean, essentially, he quit and left the Bond series at this point. Mm. He did come back and do a few more,
right?
But at this point, he said no, he'd had enough. So yes, there was an opening for someone to do it, and I think once somebody has produced the theme song, it's actually quite difficult to get another composer to come along and say, okay, I will interpolate that song into my score. It's much easier for George Martin, having to produce that song, to then work that elements of that theme into the rest of the music.
Yeah,
of the film.
It's funny, actually. I think the interviews that I read with both George and Paul about them approaching this project, both of them said that the idea of writing to order appealed to them.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of having sort of a template laid down already,
yeah,
or, you know, having a formula to follow appealed to both of them, which is quite interesting. And particularly for Paul, one of the things that I've always been quite interested in is you don't really think of Paul writing songs to order. You know, like, you don't think of, like, because he's just, I think of Paul as just constantly churning out songs left, right and centre all the time. The idea of him sitting down and trying to write a Bond song and trying to think of what a Bond song has to include for it to sound like a Bond song, that's just interesting to me. And I know that there's a thing, isn't there, where a lot of different Bond themes contain the similar note sequence that is basically using the John Barry theme and incorporating that into its song.
Yeah.
I don't think Paul's ever acknowledged that that's what he did, but it definitely does that.
I think that that's the thing that came from John Barry, because he would have co-written the theme songs for a lot of those earlier films. And so knowing what he was going to do within the score, he worked bits of the score, and particularly the James Bond theme, into the theme songs. And so I think McCartney had probably listened to those songs and realised what Barry was doing and thought that was probably the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Whether he was kind of mandated to do that by any of the higher-ups, I'm not sure. I think the one thing that anybody who wrote the theme song for a Bond film was asked to do at that point was just make sure that the title was mentioned quite early on, so that in the credits, you'll notice, if you watch a lot of the earlier films, the name of the film pops up in the titles at the exact point where it is sung.
Right, that's interesting.
So that happened. Not always, but that happened quite a lot in the early films.
It's interesting that if he, even though, like, it's going in a slightly rockier direction, like it's the direction that the themes hadn't gone in before, that he seems to have listened to them and thought, ah, this is what Bond theme songs sound like. Mm. I'm going to write in that style. Because it wasn't necessarily... I think if you say to people now, like, oh, you know, in the style of a Bond theme song, they broadly know what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's bombastic. It's probably in a minor key. Mm. There's lots of big string swells and things like that. And even though we're what, about 10 years into the Bond franchise at this point, he's able to look at that and think, okay, yeah, I know how to do one of these, you know.
Yeah.
That's a pretty specific kind of skill.
I think what's interesting about that as well is that, so Live and Let Die, let's not forget, is a song that Paul has played live, and it's been a consistent part of his live set for decades.
Yeah.
He has obviously been asked about the song lots of times, as is Paul's way,
mm-hmm.
normally tells the same two or three stories about the writing of that song.
Yeah.
When he talks about the writing of that song, he often talks about Linda having written the reggae part of the song. He talks about, which we'll get onto, I think, the idea that when he first presented the song, it might have been seen as a demo version for someone else to sing. But never once, as he said, I took John Barry's theme and wrote around that.
Yeah.
And I think we have talked before a little bit about Paul is always very reluctant to sort of give a suggestion that there should be credit placed elsewhere on his work.
Yes. Yes, I think that's fair to say.
but you feel like, you know, it would be interesting, like all the times he's been asked about that song, like, and I've seen multiple interviews with him and with other members of Wings talking about Paul like basically bashing out the chords, like you say, within the space of an afternoon or space of a day.
Mm.
But never once, as far as I'm aware, has he seemed to have publicly acknowledged that this was written around an existing sort of chord sequence or note sequence.
I think maybe he gets away with it because it isn't, to the casual listener, you might not be able to pick up the Bond theme, or at least those four chords that we're familiar with within the song Live and Let Die. But they kind of sit there. You can overlay them quite easily without it sounding off, you know?
Mm.
So I think that he's probably using that. Also, he's probably kind of forgotten just
how he wrote it. There is that, to be fair.
Yeah. But he does remember bits like the fact that Linda wrote the reggae bit.
Yes.
And also, you know, a few times you've seen him tell the story of like I had the title to start off with, which is quite rare. I don't usually have the title as a starting point. And so I thought, well, a way to approach this is to work backwards and say, well, you used to say Live and Let Live, but now you say Live and Let Die, which is his general sort of founding premise for how to arrive at the lyrics, which is really interesting. Like, you've heard him say a few things in the past about how he went about writing certain songs just through sort of or the lyrics to them just through kind of certain lyrical exercises. Like Hello Goodbye was literally just an exercise of sitting down at the piano and singing opposites until you got to ones that were sort of ones that were pleasing, you know.
And, I can see that, actually, like being presented with an idea, and I guess your first thought about how to approach that idea is contrast.
But it's also interesting that maybe it's just because he's a good storyteller, but about his own work, but he doesn't seem to sort of repeat that, you know. So it's like I use this method to write Hello Goodbye.
Yes.
And I use this method to write Live and Let Die. Both brilliant songs. But I never tried it again. You know, I just, you know, it's like, if that was me, I would get up every morning.
Here's my new song, Yes, No.
Exactly.
Left, right, up, down. Talking of lyrics, Neil, you said you had placed this song in your top three Bond themes. However, I do happen to know that you are a massive grammar pedant.
I know so where this is going.
The line, in this ever-changing world in which we live in, how does that sit with you?
Badly. I mean, I think McCartney has... I mean, again, he can't really remember and he doesn't really care. So he'll just say whatever pops into his head when anyone asks him.
Mm.
It's either in this ever-changing world in which we live in, which is grammatically horrendous, or in this ever-changing world in which we're living.
We living is like, I always heard it like that, in which we living. Okay. I one of those, you know, things where you're just kind
it's
of...
It's one or the other, yeah.
Yeah, you're not singing grammatically. I think of it as almost kind of... it's sort of deliberately ungrammatical, sort of artistic flourish.
Yeah, I just think it doesn't matter because the cadence works and it's just a nice bit of I don't know, it's just nice to listen to.
It's the cadence, yeah.
What's quite interesting is that there's another version of the song within the film.
Mm-hmm.
Bond goes into a restaurant and there's a singer on stage and she sings a version of Live and Let Die, which in itself is fascinating because that doesn't happen in any other Bond films. Nobody just comes out and sings the theme song in the middle of the film.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
In From Russia With Love, you hear From Russia With Love on the radio.
Yes.
But it's the only time really where you get it kind of in the diegesis of the film.
Mm.
But when she sings it, she definitely says, in which we live in. So yes. She definitely sings it in the grammatically incorrect way,
mm-hmm.
which makes me think that that's probably how it was written down.
Mm. So this is BJ Arno, who is singing sort of like a kind of like a disco version of the song, right?
It's a kind of a soul disco. It's a bit of everything, isn't it?
It's funk. Quite a good version as well.
It's
do you
great.
Like it? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of wah in that. So there's a huge amount of wah guitar going on in there, especially over the guitar solo. But yeah, it's quite a fun listen.
When you got a job to do, you got to do it well. You got to give the other.
It's interesting, because I kind of have just always assumed that it was the grammatically incorrect version. Mm. And this idea of Paul saying, oh, I'm not sure, it might have been in which we're living, but also actually it might be just in which we live in, which sounds cuter, I think is what he said in an interview before. Sounds a little bit like he's just sort of, you know, covering his own back and backtracking a little bit. And it genuinely doesn't, like you say, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
He
doesn't know, and so he's just saying whatever comes into his head at the time he's asked the question.
Yeah, exactly, which is all we could ask of him at any time. We should mention that there is a story that comes up again and again whenever Paul or George was asked about the making of Live and Let Die, which is that when Paul went away and recorded the entire song, I think it was the actual final version of the song as well, because he was in the middle of the Red Rose Speedway sessions at the time.
Yeah.
So he recorded the song with Wings, and when they presented that to the Bond producers...
Yeah, George Martin presented it to Harry Saltzman.
That's right.
In this anecdote, story. Which may or may not be true.
Yeah. And then the way the story goes is that Harry Saltzman was like, that sounds great, who should we get to sing it?
Yeah.
And I think Paul says, you know, what do you mean? This is the song, when he tells the story. George is even more generous with his story embellishments in it. He says, you just heard multi-award-winning singer-songwriter Paul McCartney. Who else do you want?
Guy Hamilton, the director, gets to chip in at some point in various versions of the story as well.
Oh, really?
And say, you know, obviously, you've got one of the best-selling artists of all time. Let's not look a gift horse in the mouth.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's a story that they've been telling for years, for decades. Yeah. And it was actually only recently debunked, I think, last year. There's a piece that I think did the rounds at the end of last year in the run-up to the release of the new Paul McCartney book, The McCartney Legacy, Volume 1, by Alan Cozen and Adrian Sinclair, where I think they did a lot of research into this and found the original contract for the song. And the song, the contracts apparently always stipulated that it would be a song written and performed in the movie by Paul McCartney.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those conversations that either A, may or may not have happened, full stop, and B, may have happened completely differently. But also, even in the versions that we have, can be read in lots of different ways. Like, it's entirely possible that they always knew that there was going to be a theme song, and then that theme song would then be repeated at some point during the film. And we have BJ Arno popping up and singing that song. So maybe Harry Saltzman, when he said, who do we get to sing it? He had accepted that obviously Paul McCartney was going to sing the theme song at the start of the film. But maybe he was saying, who are we going to get to sing it within the film?
Yeah.
And he was thinking about various black female artists who could have sung it during the film. I don't think we'll ever know.
That's fair. I think there's a suggestion I've read as well that the original plan for that alternate version was for the song to be performed by Fifth Dimension.
Yes.
I don't know who the Dimension are, do you?
Only from what I've read about this.
This exact anecdote. This exact situation. Who Dimension's claim to fame is that they almost sang an alternate version of the song by Paul McCartney.
There are other alternative. There's quite a lot of covers of Live and Let Die, aren't there?
Probably my main exposure to this song. I would have heard the film version first because I watched Bond films growing up with my dad, like you mentioned earlier. So I knew that. But probably the version I heard the most was the Guns N' Roses one.
Yeah, which is really good.
Yeah,
it's put to really good use in Gross Point Blank.
Oh yeah,
one of my favourite films.
Yeah. Live and let die. Live and let die.
Chrissy Hynde does a really good version on David Arnold's album of Bond cover songs. Oh, and apparently, Jerry Halliwell did a cover version.
Brilliant.
Which did I have not heard.
Right, okay.
And will not hear.
I'll try very, very hard not to.
There's a reggae version by a band called Byron Lee and the Dragonaires as well, which is excellent.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Thanks. So
that's going for reggae. So taking the reggae section in the middle and just being, you know what, that's the best bit in the song, and apply the same style to the rest of it.
Do they do the reggae section in a very in Western a rock way?
Yes.
That would be so much better.
There was an interview with Denny Searle. He suggested that the reggae part of the song, which Paul has always credited to Linda, but he suggested that actually Paul had come up with that part of the song because he knew there was that the film took part in Jamaica for some of the plot. So this idea of, again, we're going back to, there's a chase sequence, there's explosions, and also Bond's in Jamaica, let's do some reggae. Again, sort of you're like creating a song out of its component parts.
But just to nitpick, Bond does not go to Jamaica in Live and Let Die. It's filmed in Jamaica.
Oh, well, there we go.
He goes to San Monique, which is a fictional island.
Oh, well, yeah, fair enough. While we're nitpicking, it does remind me to mention that I think the story about how Paul became involved in writing the song, he said that he was asked to write it. And there's an interview where he says, I asked them to send me a copy of the book and I read it that day. And I just really enjoy this idea that Paul had to ask someone to send him a copy of the book. He couldn't just pop out to the shop himself and get one, or send someone to go and get him a copy of the book for like a fiver or whatever it was, you know.
Right.
Like, he was like, well, if you're gonna ask me to write the song, I want you to send me the book and then I'll see.
Preferably.
And he didn't even read it properly because he thought he went to Jamaica.
The manuscript that Ian Fleming typed out on his typewriter in Jamaica and then signed for me.
Yes, exactly. From Jamaica. And that's why he included the reggae section in the song.
And to be fair to him, Paul McCartney did invent reggae with Obla Di Obla Da. So, you know, he can do whatever he likes with it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Should we talk about George Martin's score?
Yeah.
You are a big score guy, right? Big score guy. Famous for it.
Yeah, Mr. Big Score. That's what we call me. Who do you think you are, Mr. Big Score? Yeah, I love a soundtrack. I love the Bond soundtracks. They're all great. That's not true. They're not all great.
Right, okay. Fine.
Some are not great.
How does George Martin's one stack up? Because, like, in terms of the context of John Barry then now not doing a Bond soundtrack and George Martin taking over, but also, like we say, presumably trying to copy the same style.
Yeah.
In isolation, how do you think it compares?
I mean, I love it. It is different to what Barry was doing, but at the same time, it's the same, and it's really hard to pinpoint where it's different and where it's the same. But all of those exciting action cues are there, and the romance is there. The strings and the brass and the percussion are there that Barry uses, but all used slightly differently. So the strings are used differently, I think. The brass is used differently. I think the percussion is a bit harder in George Martin than it is in John Barry. Because of the time, I think it's, and because it's kind of based off a rock song.
And maybe because of the film's subject matter, you know, so like lots of it's taking place in Harlem. Like, we're getting, you know, the sort of piggybacking on the sort of blaxploitation thing that's happening in cinema at that time.
Yeah.
And I suppose, and it's, you can hear that a bit of that in the score. There's a lot more sort of wild guitar in this, but it's sort of like disco beats and things like
that. Well, electric guitar and electric bass are certainly a lot more obvious than they had been in John Barry. But John Barry had always said that Bond music was this kind of mixture of genres. You had jazz, pop, rock, classical music is in there and swing is in there. And he said, I've got this quote here, he said, you need big, strong brass chords and sustained strings, and you need those to stand up against the special effects, the fights, the explosions, the gunshots and everything.
Yeah.
So George Martin's doing all that, but he is doing it in his own way. I really like it. It's one of the ones that I go back to and listen to more than the others, because it's a very exciting listen. It hasn't got any kind of, it doesn't really sag. It hasn't got any slow, well, it has got some slow bits, but they don't drag. But yeah, the Monty Norman score for Dr. No is kind of a bit weird because it's largely Calypso songs. So I think for the purposes of this exercise, we can discount that. Everything else that John Barry did, all brilliant, all great. But it's actually quite nice to then have a change of mood slightly. It's different enough to be interesting, but the same enough to still be recognisably Bond.
Is it normal for Bond scores to incorporate the melody of the Bond theme within the score? Rather than just focus on the main Bond theme, the John Barry elements?
Yeah.
Because this does incorporate a lot of the Live and Let Die melodies that Paul wrote for his song.
I'd say it's very common in Bond scores to have melodies and elements of the theme song crop up again in the score. That is a common thing. It doesn't happen all the time because sometimes the song has been written entirely separately from the score, maybe with totally different people working on it.
And sometimes the themes presumably just don't have that catchy a melody.
Well, you're probably thinking of Die Another Day, for example, which has no real melody at all. And David Arnold wrote the score for that completely separately from Madonna writing her song.
Right.
So there's absolutely nothing of Madonna's song in that score. And that does happen a couple of times, but by and large, you will find that whoever's written the score has got involved at some point, if possible, in the writing of the song. And so, there will be a kind of through line there.
Because I think that through not being a big score guy, I do enjoy picking out those elements of the song.
Yeah.
And because it is such a great melody. And because the song itself is made up of separate components, right? There are like four different sections that make up the entire song, each with their own distinct melody.
Yeah.
And you can hear them getting picked out throughout the score.
Well, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da is so great for any action scenes.
Yes,
you can just blast, you can just do what you like with that.
And I think, because I There's an interview with Denny Sewell, who's the drummer in Wings at the time, okay. when they were recording this session. In the interview, he says that that was the first bit that Paul wrote for the song, and it's because he was like, I need a chase sequence for the theme. So he apparently had already thought of that and called it basically the chase sequence for the theme. And then the big four chords is the explosions that you get with a Bond theme. It sounds like the way that Denny had talked about this in this interview was that like Paul saw them as different components that make up okay. a Bond film.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
I mean, that's fair, honestly, but yeah, it seems unlikely that you would write a song thinking, well, this bit will go with the chase sequences. But it does seem likely that if you were trying to write a song that sounds like a Bond film, then yes, you would have a fun.
And there's a really early interview, I think, with Paul where he talks about getting the commission for writing the theme. And there's almost an implication that he might be involved in the writing of the score as well.
Okay.
And he talks about this and he says, I think he even says, like, I'm not sure about writing the score. But I do wonder if he's approached the theme with that in mind. Like, he's thinking about what bits would he be able to pick out to use for certain, you know, parts of the film itself.
Okay.
Obviously that then went to George Martin. And...
Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know that he ever thought he would be writing the score. That's, if that happened, that's... outside of my world.
I think if you think about, so 1966 when Paul and George Martin collaborate on the score for The Family Way, like we're sort of given to understand that Paul's main contribution for that was that he kind of wrote the sort of main motif or refrain and sort of played it to George Martin on a piano, from which George Martin basically wrote the whole score that incorporated that motif over and over again, and then
so it could be a similar thing to which, and as from what I understand, that is essentially what happened here, right? So Paul wrote the song, then gave it for George to work out with the orchestral parts of the song, and then George then went on to write the score for the film using similar sort of phrasing as he'd already done.
Yeah, makes sense.
George Martin actually had previous with Bond. Don't know if you knew about this. But he was involved in the production of Matt Monro's song for From Russia with Love in 1963. Oh. And one of the things that George Martin did in that song was recorded a piano track. I forget which way around it is, but he's either recorded it at half speed and an octave higher, or he's recorded it at double speed and an octave lower, I can't remember. But when he's played it back, he's made the piano sound a bit like a cymbalum, which is a kind of instrument that you would hear in... Eastern European situations, such as Bond finds himself in that film. Okay. So there are some, if you listen to the song, the theme song from Rush With Love, quite early on you will hear this cymbalum type sound, which is actually a piano, which George Martin has manipulated to make.
That's interesting.
Which is a very George Martin thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah,
of course. Yeah. But, you know, if you're doing that in 1963, I suppose, what are the things that were sort of sped up and sped down? So the In My Life...
piano solo that sounds like a harpsichord.
The guitar solo in Hard Day's Night, so that was like played at half speed and then sped up again. So he seems to be quite innovative. I don't really know whether like other people are using these techniques. Certainly, like we spoke in the episode about the produced by George Martin documentary, how he seems to have been sort of liberated by working with the Beatles and just let his creative spirit run free.
Yes. But again, like by following almost like a template that they set out, or at least following the lead that they set out for him, you know, like in going back to this idea of George being given sort of a license to do something creative, but within rules. It does feel like the Beatles sort of almost laid out the groundwork for him to be able to play within those kinds of rules. And also interesting, you mentioned that George Martin documentary. We should obviously reference the fact that there is a big part of that documentary where they make a lot of effort to link George Martin to Bond.
Yes.
Through, obviously, his work on Live and Let Die, but mostly because there's like a really long shot of George Martin looking very, very dashing and really like smouldering look, smoking a cigarette,
okay.
looking like the most impossibly sexy man you've ever seen in your life. Mm. enabled to have like a bit of like a Bond music playing sort of at the same time, almost suggesting that he could have played Bond. Yeah. And I don't disagree.
John Barry is another one who, in his heyday, you could see as a Bond.
Oh, really?
And they both... John Barry lived with Michael Caine for a while, and you can kind of see Caine as a Bond figure in some ways. Yeah. I think, basically, if you were a kind of white man in your 30s in the 60s, then you were pretty cool, and you just generally looked like Bond.
Yeah, yes.
I think that's how it works?
Yes, that's exactly how it works.
George Martin also followed John Barry and Monty Norman and preceded David Arnold in that long line of Bond composers who share two first names in their name.
Yeah. Wow, you've cracked this wide open.
I really have.
I've got another George Martin Bond connection to throw at you.
Do it.
I'm sure you already know it already. I'm going to give you a name. Vic Flick.
Oh, the Flickster.
The Flickster.
Yeah, right. I've just called him that. Nobody called him that until now.
But it works, right? Who is Vic Flick? Can you tell us?
Vic Flick was the guitarist who worked with John Barry on the arrangement of the James Bond theme in the first place. So the very famous ding 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 ding. That's Vic Flick playing the guitar. Yeah, he went on to play on most, if not all, of John Barry's scores. He played that.
He also was part of the George Martin Orchestra that played on the Hard Day's Night film.
Oh, really?
And he also, because when it came to Help, George Martin actually hired most of the musicians who played on the Goldfinger soundtrack to recreate the similar kind of Bond style music for
Bond,
that film, including a very specific Bond-like riff that is Vic Flick as well playing that.
Oh, I did not know that.
Which is
that's really
good,
interesting.
Good Bond knowledge.
Yeah,
Bond trivia.
It's interesting at that point. So in 1965, we talked about this. Sorry, I keep on referencing previous episodes.
You know, we've got a few under our belt now. Let's do it.
Yeah, I'm a canny marketeer, if nothing else. But in our episode about Help, we talked a bit about the fact that there are sort of Bond references in it, or like, you know, but particularly in the score more than anything else. But that by 1965, it was seen that that was a thing that was sort of culturally well-known and relevant enough that you could make references to. Mm. Things like that rely on consensus, right? They rely on the fact that you can make this reference and people think, ah, yeah, that sounds a bit like James Bond, you know. But, you know, at this point, because, you know, James Bond mentions the Beatles in Goldfinger. I think it's Goldfinger, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And he says something about it would be... No, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do the voice. He says, it would be like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs. And is that what he says? Something like that.
Yes, he's referring to drinking Dom Perignon 53 above a temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit, which would be as bad as listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
Right.
Yeah. Bond, they're really speaking to the same working class demographic as Beatles fans.
It's a really interesting moment in Bond history because there's very few cultural references in Bond films. Nobody really talks about pop music or films or anything like that in the Bond films.
Right, so. Right. Because those are the kind of things that you think references like that, you know, If we make references like that, it might date it, you know. But what it says to me is like, so at this point, the Beatles are thought of as a fad, because there is no template for a pop band that has lasted.
Sure,
the whole point of pop bands is to be ephemeral, to come along, do some hit singles, and then you stick those on an album so you can sell them again, and then like nobody's heard of them a year from now. Mm-hmm. And everyone keeps asking the Beatles at this point, how long are you going to last? And they all say, "Oh, you know, hopefully another year or two, if it all goes well." You know, that's kind of, you know, there's no thought that anyone's going to be talking about the Beatles in 60 years from now. And what it says to me is that maybe the James Bond franchise thinks of itself the same way. No one's thinking like, "Well, we better not make this cultural reference about this thing that is a fad."
Yeah,
because you know, what if people who are watching this film in 60 years think, who are this band, the Beatles? I don't know, that's an obscure reference from the early 60s. I suppose, you know, these big film franchises that we're so familiar with now, at the time, I suppose, nobody really had any thought about building a franchise that was going to last ages and ages and ages.
No, I mean, Bond is interesting because at that point when Goldfinger was made in 64, you did have a series of 12 or 13 books. So they knew that they could have gone on and made a load more.
Yeah.
But they're on the third one, and Goldfinger was the one that was super successful, that really rocketed the franchise into kind of the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
But they didn't know that when they were making it, when they were writing it. So, yes, there's every chance that they didn't know how many more they had in them.
Yeah.
But also, nobody in 1964, if you watched a film in 1964, that was it. You didn't expect to see that again unless it was re-released.
Yeah.
It was a long time before films started to be shown regularly on the telly. Nobody, certainly nobody in the making of Goldfinger was thinking about anybody at home watching a Blu-ray and kind of pausing it and rewinding it and listening to those and studying those lines incessantly. You know, nobody was for any films.
Doing an entire hour podcast about it.
what kind of world would that be?
But the other thing it says to me, like that reference, is that it sort of puts James Bond on the side of the establishment. You know, the Beatles are a disruptive anti-establishment force at this time.
Yeah.
And James Bond is nailing his colours to the mast and saying, you know, I'm like the rest of you and I think this is a silly fad.
Yeah. He's still very much part of, as you say, the establishment, the British Empire,
which,
you know, is 1964, what was left of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird thing to do.
It's interesting that the Beatles make the cut. Though, like, if you're going to reference anyone, even at that in that year, that it made sense to do it with the Beatles. Like that there was a sort of a recognition there that if anyone's going to be important enough for Bond's references, like imagine now 60 years on, we're talking about a reference that Bond made to Herman's Hermits. You know, like, it doesn't quite have the same ring to it, but it could have easily been that.
Roger Moore's Bond definitely listened to Herman's Hermits.
Are on the subject, any other Beatles Bond connections that we know of?
Well, there's a vague one and then there's a very big one. So the vague one is that Sean Connery, when he kind of got fed up with Bond at the end of, after You Only Live Twice, he was getting mobbed in the streets, he compared that to Beatlemania. And he said that's one of the reasons why he's had enough. And he said, you know, there are four of the Beatles and they get to kind of spread it out between them, but there's only one of me, so... That's kind of one of those stories in Bond lore where you always hear the Beatles mentioned. I mean, the other big one is, of course, the launch of both Bond and the Beatles famously happened on the same day. Yeah. I think, and Ed will correct me because he's looking at me as if he's just waiting for me to say the wrong day. 5th of October, 1962.
I couldn't tell you, but I know it was October 1962.
Was the day that Dr. No was released in cinemas and also the day that Love Me Do was released. First Beatles single, in case you didn't know that, Ed.
I had no idea.
No idea.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, let me tell you. I'll take you to one side and tell you all about the Beatles.
Thank you.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder if there is a reason... I know there's a reason why two such huge popular pop culture phenomenons can start at exactly the same time. We've talked often about, you know, the 60s being a revolutionary period in time that allowed the Beatles to, I guess, lead the way in many ways.
Mm.
But there's a lot of social change happening at that time that allowed them to become as popular as they were. And I guess a similar kind of thing for Bond. You know, things were changing at a time that allowed him to become this massive cultural...
Yeah,
it's fertile
ground.
Yeah, but I think, as we were saying, I mean, that thing about sort of James Bond being an establishment figure, you know, one of the reasons the Beatles could become so popular, and pop music in general could start breaking through, was that, you know, teenagers had, well, the term teenager had only recently been coined. It was coined around that time. And they had disposable income for the first time, sort of post-war. That hadn't really happened. And they could do things like go out and buy 7-inch singles with the money they had and things like that. The explosion in popularity of the James Bond franchise, I'm not really sure what the audience was for that, because it wasn't sort of, it's not the same audience that the Beatles are appealing to.
You haven't got the same people mobbing the Fab Four and then crossing the street and mobbing Connery.
No. No. And it is weird because also the audience for the books would have been a much older audience.
Yeah.
And the book and the films were then clearly aimed at a younger audience and got progressively younger. Mm. So yeah, it's unlikely that there was a crossover or a deliberate crossover, but you know, maybe it just happened organically.
Is it young men, generally speaking, that audience? There's sort of male wish fulfillment fantasies, I suppose, right?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
It's the sort of, you know, taking decisive action, not asking anyone else for help and just sorting everything out yourself, you know, and, you know, maybe a bit of snogging into the bargain. then just, you know, shoot a guy. And that's the whole franchise. Yeah. One of the things you notice in this is, so we're introduced to Roger Moore as James Bond for the first time in his flat. And it struck me that you don't actually see where James Bond lives all that much. Is this the first time we see where James Bond lives?
This is not the first time, this is the second time, but there have only been three times. Mm. So you see his flat in Dr. No, you see it in Live and Let Die, and then you see it again in Spectre. And what's quite interesting is that each time you see Bond's flat, it's kind of reflective of the actor's portrayal of Bond.
Yeah.
So Connery's, the flat that you see in Dr. No, is kind of classic and angular. When you get to Spectre, you see Daniel Craig, and it's very functional and unemotional and empty and kind of spare. And then in Live and Let Die, you see this really, I don't know, a little bit porny. It's like it's a sort of a porn film.
It's absolutely a 70s bachelor.
Yeah, bachelor. It's gadget obsessed. It's completely vulgar. It's very Roger Moore's Bond. And I find it fascinating, to be honest. I love the fact that we don't see it very often. The fact that we've seen it three times in 60 years, I think, is great. Because what it also means is that you can pore over those moments. So when I was watching Live and Let Die in preparation for this, I paused it and I had a good look around Roger Moore's kitchen. And it's just really weird because he's got all of this cooking equipment out that you just can't imagine Bond. If you think about the Bond character, especially from the books, you just can't think of him ever using any of this shit. It's just loads of stuff lying around his house. I mean, you wouldn't care about a massive coffee machine that takes up half the kitchen.
It does take up half the kitchen, doesn't it? Yeah, it's ridiculous.
But what I noticed this time, for the first time ever, I did a freeze frame and I noticed that in the bottom left corner, if you watch really carefully, there's what appears to be a Breville sandwich maker. And a bright orange Breville sandwich maker in the just sitting there on the counter of James Bond's kitchen. Can you imagine James Bond making a toasty? What would he put in it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I always go for just baked beans in mine.
But, oh, do you? But no, ham and cheese.
Yeah.
Ham and cheese. But I can't... What is he making that for? He's not making his own lunch. He's not sending himself off with a packed lunch to MI6 headquarters.
No, absolutely not. I mean, maybe he's entertaining absconded Italian female agents with his baked beans.
The whole beginning to this... And I don't know how you feel about this. The beginning of the entire film is odd to me.
Yeah.
So it starts off with the killing of three agents.
Yes.
Right? One of which is killed... one of which, the agent, is the UK representative in the United Nations.
Yes.
And he's killed by noise.
Sound, yeah.
Yes, he's killed by sound.
Definitely possible.
And no one in the room does anything when they realise he's in agony and collapses. No one reacts. The second is Baines getting killed in New Orleans during the funeral sequence.
That's actually the third, but carry on.
No, it's not. Because the third is the guy getting bitten by a snake.
Yeah, because that's the
thing. That's Baines.
Okay, sorry.
The first one is the guy in the UN.
Yes.
The second one is the funeral in New Orleans.
I thought that was Baines. The agent who gets killed. Okay.
Yeah. Baines is the guy who gets killed in Sam Lake.
And he gets killed by a snake bite. And there's a nice moment now. I don't know if it's deliberate, but it sounds like the tension that happens in the score during that sequence when you see the snake nearing Baines' face is very, very similar to the Day in Life.
Yeah, those Martin strings that kind of rise and rise to a crescendo, and then the snake bite happens, and then those strings go back down again.
It's interesting, isn't it? I wonder, like, George Martin thinking to himself, well, I've got to throw a Beatles reference in there.
Yeah,
like, do you think he approaches all of his projects like that? Like,
I wonder whether it's just a sort of Easter egg, you know,
yeah,
kind of thing, or whether, I mean, that's a new technique, right? I mean, so that sound in Day in the Life is like they had an orchestra in Abbey Road, and I think mainly Paul like kind of stood and just said, they said to like every member of this orchestra, I want you to go, you've got this many bars, and I want you to go from your lowest note to your highest note.
Yes. Like, so this, yes. This, in your own time or by a certain point.
Yeah. But like you have to get there by this point after this many bars. These are all, you know, different instruments in different keys and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no way that should work. But it does somehow.
And your man, what's his name, is counting. You can hear him in the background.
Mal Evans.
Yeah. I would love to have heard Mal Evans counting during the score of Live and Let Die. Or just standing to one side while that guy's getting bitten by a snake.
Yeah, yeah.
In the scene?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know how much Bond trivia you want from me that is not Beatles related.
Why else are you here?
So this is a very interesting pre-title sequence because it doesn't feature James Bond.
Right, and this is what I was going to say. It does feel a little bit out of sorts with what has come before.
From Russia with Love technically doesn't feature James Bond.
Oh yeah,
it's supposed to be somebody else wearing a Sean Connery mask.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Of course, yes.
But yeah, this doesn't feature James Bond, and then it goes straight into the scene in Bond's flat where M and Miss Moneypenny turn up at Bond's flat, which I find very difficult to deal with because I don't believe for a moment that M would ever step outside of his office to go to Bond's flat.
And also, I find it quite interesting that the first time we see, like in the context of this is Roger Moore's first film as Bond, the first time we see Bond is him in his flat, but also him being caught off guard by M. And almost the first time we see Moore's Bond is him almost like a naughty schoolboy.
It's a really low key first appearance of an actor in a Bond role. If you watch all of the other actors' first films, they've all got quite an interesting,
like, dramatic entrance.
Exactly. Kind of but no, not this one.
And he seems quite flustered. Like, I don't think of Bond. I can't imagine Sean Connery's Bond being put in the same situation where he's like, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm almost like a little bit panicky. Yeah. Like I need to steer M away. Yeah. From the,
I mean, he probably just wouldn't answer the door, or he just shoots at the door. Also, one of the only Bond film. Okay, I have to put a lot of qualifiers into this.
Uh-huh.
Q is not in this film, right?
That's true, yeah.
And that until you get to the Daniel Craig era, where it was all rebooted, Q, or at least an armourer, was in every Bond film. He was played by a different actor in Dr. No, but this was the first time, right up until the end of the Pierce Brosnan era, where there was no Q.
Right.
Okay. Which I think was also part of the urge to move away from.
But that's interesting. They still mention Q, though.
Q Branch is mentioned, yeah. I think Moneypenny says something like Q's fixed your watch.
It's not a huge departure, is it?
No, it's not. But it just feels like it was a bit of a trope that Bond had to go into M's office, be debriefed by M, get his gadgets from Q, and then go on his mission. Whereas this time, M comes to Bond's flat. Moneypenny gives him the gadget. There's just a few little changes.
It's almost like they're willfully not indulging those tropes.
Yeah,
he doesn't revert to them later in the franchise.
But he doesn't even get the chance to do his catchphrase. Like Mr. Big cuts him off. He starts saying, "Oh, my name is Bond, James Bond," and Mr. Big says, "Names is for tombstones."
Oh, yes, that's like, right.
So I suppose
he does get. He does say it to Solitaire. He does get the thing out to Solitaire. I'm referring to the catchphrase.
He does.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
I mean,
like, he gets it out wrong.
Remarkable how much, like, you're not a Roger Moore fan, but you will indulge in innuendo.
You mentioned earlier that obviously we have the three agents being killed, and it goes straight into Bond in his apartment. But obviously between that, we actually have the song Live and Let Die, which is obviously why we're here. And the theme sequence, or the credit sequence that plays underneath that, in some ways I thought was really effective. Like there's this imagery of, you know, you have these, you know, typical sort of credit sequence Bond girls silhouettes.
Yeah.
And otherwise, some of them almost like emulating matches with like the like flames on their head.
Yeah.
And then when those big striking chords come in from the song, their faces like burst into like a skull.
Mm.
And that's very, very dramatic. I think a very evocative imagery to go with the song itself.
Mm-hmm.
In other ways, It's quite basic.
Yeah. So I think Maurice Binder, we should credit with those title sequences. He designed them and shot them.
Right.
Yeah.
Did he always do them, and did he continue to do them?
He did them from Thunderball onwards until License to Kill was the last one that he did. For Live and Let Die, he possibly didn't have a great number of ideas, I think it's fair to say.
Well, because I guess that was my question, because I think of like those sequences as being really elaborate. You've got these silhouetted, naked girls being fired from guns and bursting into like a deck of cards or whatever.
There's not a lot of that in this one.
No.
There's the skull. So there's the voodoo theme from the film, which I suppose comes through the skull, and the bursting into flames, which matches the chords from the song, which are lovely. You've got these beautiful black models who are largely not in silhouette, and actually you can see quite a lot.
Yes,
you know, and as a young boy watching those films with my dad, I found it quite awkward sometimes.
Sure.
But let's not go into that. So yeah, but there's no, you know, you're right, there's not a lot more than that. It's not one of, I think he came up with like one really great idea.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
For it and stuck with it.
Yeah.
It's not one that Alan Partridge could narrate at great length.
which is the true mark of a Bond
credit. Exactly, yes.
I don't know whether there is an official Live and Let Die music video. I mean, I was looking that up. There's a lot of live performances of the time, and I guess ones that are attributed to being sort of an official Live and Let Die video, but I don't know if there was a music video that was released to coincide the song beyond this credit sequence.
I don't think so. There is the performance from the James Paul McCartney TV special, which I think is Wings debuting the song, and that's the one where, so you might have seen where the sort of pyrotechnics go off at the end, and like it, Paul's piano effectively blows up, and the studio audience ends up getting shards of splintered wood rained down on them. So yeah, but I think that's probably it. I'm not sure there's an actual music video.
I need to watch that. That sounds horrendous. As dramatic as the film itself.
Yeah.
That'd be great, though, to go home from that gig and for whoever you came home to say, what's that sticking out of your head? That's Paul McCartney's piano. Oh, amazing. Sell it.
Just part of the ever-changing world in which we live in.
In which we're living.
I think we might have covered everything that we need to. Before we go, any other Beatles Bond connections anybody's hiding away?
Oh, I do have one. There is a very popular cameo appearance in this, or a supporting role. Clifton James is Sheriff J.W. Pepper.
Oh my yes, gosh. I didn't mention him for a reason.
who then also pops up in Man with the Golden Gun?
Yes.
Right, and he's in the car with Bond when he does the big loop
yep.
stunt. He also, that actor also pops up in Superman 2, playing a character called the Sheriff, who is effectively just the yes. same character, basically. Wow. I'm not sure he's called J.W. Pepper in it. And Superman 2, of course, directed by...
Richard Lester.
Wow. Director of... It started being directed by Richard Donner, yeah. but he was rubbish, so they took him off it, and they put Richard Lester on. They were like, you directed two films with the Beatles in, you're brilliant, we'll put you in instead.
Fine.
Fact.
So, I'm not going to argue with you. So your Beatles Bond connection
yes.
is that one of the actors in this film played a similar role
yep.
in a film that was directed by someone who also directed some Beatles films.
Yes.
I can't believe you missed the fact that George Harrison played solitaire.
There is a picture of George Harrison wearing a 007 t-shirt.
Yes, there is. That's right. Yes.
How that? Is that yeah. better?
That's a bit better.
Yeah, it's probably better.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
We're really scraping the bottom of the Bond Beatles barrel now.
Fair enough.
And in which case, we should probably leave it there. I hope if you've been listening to this, you've enjoyed the episode and you've enjoyed all of our Bond trivia facts and that you've enjoyed listening to Neil, our resident Bond expert. Thank you so much for coming on to our podcast, Neil.
Thank you for having me. This is the best podcast I have ever been on.
Good. I wasn't expecting that. Genuinely wasn't expecting that, but I'll take it. Thank you very much. Do you agree? Is this the best podcast that Neil has ever been on? If so, let us know. You can reach us on all of the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. You can also leave us a review or a 5-star rating on your podcast listening platform of choice. Otherwise, we will see you again soon for another bonus episode, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.